This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's been about a year since the Lilly Endowment announced which Indiana schools would be getting groundbreaking grants to be able to implement some innovative changes in school counseling. We're going to find out more from the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, Tammy Silverman. Also today, we'll check in with the Welcome Project and bring you the latest conversation from the project based at Valparaiso University. And we'll also bring you the second of the two-part series from reporter Steve Berger, looking into psychologists dealing on whether mentally ill or disabled defendants are be able to stand trial. And we'll also bring you a conversation with GasBuddy.com senior analyst Patrick DeHaan. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Last fall, the Lilly Endowment announced a groundbreaking $22 million investment to be able to help spark some innovative, sustainable, comprehensive school counseling programs. Well, some school districts here in Northwest Indiana have taken advantage of these grants, and we'll find out how these schools have done. We have with us the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, Tammy Silverman, on the phone from her office in Indianapolis. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, for people who are not familiar with the Lilly Endowment's project, first explain what the Lilly Endowment is doing and is still doing, I guess, but intended to do starting last fall to help school districts out.
Well, and I certainly don't speak on their behalf, but I will tell you, IYI was one of the technical assistance providers for the planning and implementation grants. And so we worked with about 90 school districts. So, You know, we got a pretty good sense of what was going on, and they really, for a number of years, have been paying close attention to the challenges that our kids are having in schools that our school counselors are specifically equipped to address. And the challenges, there simply isn't enough access to those school counselors. So again, their board and their great wisdom came up with and made a large investment and issued this grant challenge to the state. And a lot of the school districts stepped up and put together some great proposals, and were recently awarded those funds.
Now, I understand that the Lilly Endowment's intent was to help the school districts out that have been reporting back in and probably complaining for years about the fact that they are running into more and more problems with students, and they have too fewer counselors to help these students not only deal with maybe personal problems, but to be sure, deal with the problems they have that are causing problems in their educational process. And I know that the initiative that the Lilly Endowment has set up here was trying to help along and to help put it, make, well, I guess, more people available. It could be counselors, training, and the like here, too. But we know that when you look at Lake County in particular, there are several school districts that have received the grants. Tell us about the local ones and what they're being able to take advantage of through the Lilly Endowment program.
Sure. So the Hanover Community School Corporation was awarded a nice, healthy grant of a little over $200,000. Lake Ridge New Tech Schools also received an award of $188,300. And then School City of East Chicago received $442,000. And so they all, you know, the great thing about this grant that I will say is that unlike some other initiatives, this one was wide open, and it allowed the school districts to really take a look at themselves and say, what do our students need? And if that is an additional licensed counselor, great. If that is someone to take some of that administrative work off the plate of their existing counselors in order to free up more of their time, that works too. If it's more outreach to parents, that can go in there as well. So it really allowed each and every district to customize their request to hopefully best meet the needs of those kids. And like you said, the needs that popped up the most frequently from across the state were really those social and emotional challenges that our kids are facing.
Mm-hmm. Does it turn out that in your folks' discovery, when you were working with the Lilly Endowment on the plans for this initiative, that it was just a matter of, you know, as we said before, that there are too few counselors, and the counselors are so busy, they're not getting the time to be able to spend and help youngsters?
You're absolutely right. And the other thing is, different than teachers who obviously have a classroom schedule, the counselors are kind of viewed as, you know, more flexible, right? So they were often asked to proctor tests. They're often asked to help with a lot of administrative duties. They're often asked to do all these things, which are obviously important to a school district, but yet aren't fully utilizing the training and the skills that these folks have. And so hopefully these grants will allow them to spend more time on some of these really complex issues that the students have. And we're talking about things like teamwork, stress management, self-control. Also, we're seeing more, obviously, peer cruelty is a term that came out kind of this, that it's not just the cyberbullying or the bullying, but it's really that lack of empathy that I think maybe back in my day we used to call citizenship, you know, that kind of an idea, as well as some of those big issues. Unfortunately, many of our schools in our state are struggling with teens who have contemplated or attempted to take their own lives.
Do you think that maybe also in the case of the fact that the counselors didn't have time because of their duties that they had to not only to be able to be counselors, but also called on to help out in other ways in the school district, that maybe they ended up in some cases ended up being substitute teachers in some cases to fill in for staff that were sick or the like, and that in turn took them away from their counseling duties?
Well, and I'll tell you, yes, I think along the same lines as what we've heard from the schools. In fact, one counselor, again, a licensed, experienced counselor, was in charge of the school mascot. So rather than working with kids on suicide prevention or if they're being raised in a home where there's a parental drug addiction, those kinds of things, she literally was in charge of scheduling, you know, the mascot, the Panther head, to make sure it gets to the football team on the football field at the right time. So obviously that is not the best use of her skills and abilities.
Important job, but somebody else could probably do it. Other than a counselor, I suppose. So, in the op-ed piece that you made available here to the statewide media, you talk about one school district in northern Indiana in particular, and they had some issues, and how they have been able to take advantage of the Lilly Counseling Initiative to make some big changes, and they got the community involved, not just the school district and the teachers and the students.
Absolutely. Well, in our work with the school districts, we ended up doing a very large pool of surveys. So many of the districts wanted to actually reach out and talk to their staff, their parents, and their students. And one of the big takeaways from that is that both the teachers, the counselors, and the parents both want more engagement. And that was interesting. They're just having challenges making those connections. So one school district already kicked off an engagement and an empathy initiative. And so with that, their community foundation immediately stepped up and said, this is exciting stuff that's going on, and we want to be part of it. So we've seen that throughout the state, that many of the schools, just even having this conversation and the first planning phase of this grant, helped them to create some new pathways, some new initiatives, and most definitely new energy around the fact that these counselors can really make a big difference for our kids.
Now, in checking in with the education schools in Indiana, what do the teachers who teach the teachers have to say about these ideas that the Lilly Endowment Initiative has put out?
Well, and again, I don't want to pretend to speak on their behalf, but there were several universities that did also receive some funding so that they could, you know, expand their programs as well. You know, Ball State, UIndy, Oakland City University, Indiana University Southeast, Indiana Wesleyan. You know, each of those, because again, a lot of our teachers and counselors are dealing with monumentally complex issues, many of which weren't perhaps around, you know, particularly dealing with kids who are growing up in an opioid addicted home or the high levels of suicide ideation that we have now. And it's great that they also, you know, that the endowment backed it up and said, not only do we want to help the existing counselors, but let's help with the preparation of our up-and-coming counselors as well.
So it sounds like that even in this initial effort, the Lilly Initiative has done a lot of good and certainly got things started in a lot of communities across Indiana to make it easier for counselors to get their jobs done and help the young people out that need the help the most.
Absolutely. We've already seen so many positive outcomes. The other thing that was wholly unanticipated but is great news is that because of the great need, and there was a large number, it's our understanding, a large number of applications that came in that were close but not quite fundable, the endowment is going to do another round of these grants for up to $10 million.
That's great.
So if there's a school district that maybe applied the first time and didn't get it, or a school district that thought about applying and that for whatever reason didn't do that, they still do have another opportunity, and those applications, there will be more information about the details coming out, so our understanding, mid-October, and those will be due in March of 2018.
That's great. We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And Tammy, one of the other things we wanted to talk about when we had the chance to speak today was about the upcoming 2017 Because Kids Count Conference. That's going to be held in November in Indianapolis.
It is. We have a Leadership Institute on Monday, November 27th, and then the conference itself is Tuesday the 28th and Wednesday the 29th. And it is, for a long time, we thought it was the state's largest gathering of youth workers, and we've recently been told it's actually the Midwest's largest gathering of youth workers.
Wow.
Tons of workshops from all different topics, from all of those things we were just talking about, is grit and resilience, social, emotional, mental health issues of teens, and just really a great way for all the people that are doing such great work with kids in our communities to connect, get some new information, and also rejuvenate and kind of come back rededicated to help address all those needs that we know are out there.
Let's talk here in more detail about at least a couple of the workshops. So there are about 60 of them, I understand. In that 2-day event, that's quite a lot. And you and your staff have to help organize all this in Indianapolis. But one of the ones that stands out when I was looking at the list here was one that talks about the impact that poverty has on schools and how to change a poverty mindset. That sounds very interesting. Where do you find people to talk about that to bring them in for a workshop?
Well, right. So really, we have a couple of great folks that really scour the country to see what is going on and what are some of those best practices that we can bring to Indiana to talk about. You know, we know those are issues, again, that are impacting our kids, and we've heard that time and time again from after-school programs as well as from the educators. And we know that the idea that, you know, there's this kind of sometimes labeling that happens with those kids just because they're being raised in an economically disadvantaged household, that's going to label them forever. And we need to break that mindset, obviously. We want every Hoosier child to reach their full potential. And we have a great expert coming in who's going to talk about how we can make sure that we're checking ourselves and make sure that we're providing all of those skills and abilities to make sure all of those kids grow up to be healthy and productive Hoosier citizens.
And I understand, too, that the event coming up here at the end of November at the Indiana Convention Center in Indianapolis is going to also feature a couple of very special thought leader sessions. Tell us about the folks who are going to be facilitating those events and what they're about.
Well, absolutely. We have one individual who herself was a foster child, and we know that Indiana actually right now, unfortunately, we just became the leading state in the number of kids and the number of households that have had a child removed due to those parental addictions. So this individual was herself a foster child. Now she is a youth advocate talking about what that means. Her name's Ashley Rose Porter, and she'll be there on November 28th. And then Kevin Carroll, he's the author of The Red Rubber Ball, and that really talks about how do you fully maximize a child's potential and really make sure that we as those working in the field are doing everything possible to help each child. And so he's going to be there on the 29th. Both of them are tremendously energizing, as well as they have that direct experience component that so speaks to us.
Now, if anybody happens to be interested or you have qualified staff members that should take part in this event, how can they find out more about it?
It is right on our website at iyi.org. You just click on the conferences, and there's a great amount of detail about all the breakout sessions and what that's going to look like, and there's a way to sign up right online.
That's great. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And as always, Tammy, thanks for being with us. And we appreciate the comments and the best of luck to everybody, especially with this upcoming conference in Indianapolis.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Chris.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. I attended a small high school called Morgan Park Academy on the south side of Chicago. I actually started going to Morgan Park Academy in the seventh grade. The reason I started going there is my father went to the public school that I was attending, Fort Dearborn. When he got there, he talked with the teacher, and the teacher noted some problems that I was having, hanging with the wrong crowd, and then the teacher asked my father if I was interested in having him go to another school. So they ended up putting me in private school and taking me out of public school in the seventh grade. I was what you call a latchkey kid, meaning you stay home until the parents came home at 2-3 in the afternoon, and then you could go out. But until then, you stay in the house. You don't let anyone in the house. I was always told to work on homework after school. So for 2 hours after school, I would have to sit and make sure I worked on homework. But I was rather lazy and mischievous in the classroom. Just getting into a lot of trouble, a lot of referrals to the principal's office, not paying attention in class, just not really being focused on what I needed to academically. And I guess he saw something that said, hey, this kid could go either way unless his parents kind of step in and do something different with him. My family wasn't an affluent family. Both of my parents were postal workers. So they worked that postal shift night and day, rain, sleet, or snow. And they put me in private school, which was a bit of a culture shock for me because I was then in a school with kids that had more affluent families, meaning they were doctors, lawyers, politicians, things of that nature. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me in the beginning because I would have to travel about an hour to get to the school, so taking the bus one way while my other friends and people that I knew and grew up with in the neighborhood were going another way was a bit of a transition. I remember my uncle used to take me to school in the seventh grade, and my uncle drove a cab. So my uncle would drop me off right in front of the school in this big old Beetle Volkswagen-looking taxi cab, and the kids would ask me, why do you drive a cab to school? And I remember very vividly telling them, my parents are so rich that they had to hire a cab for me because I was embarrassed about, coming to school in a cab when other kids were getting there in BMWs and Audis and, other, bigger cars. And I remember an embarrassing moment, and I think my uncle caught on. I never asked him if he did. But in the seventh grade, I acted like I had a basketball injury and I was limping because I was getting teased so much about coming to school in this cab. I had him stop a little further back and told him, I wanted to walk this injury off. So the biggest transition I had to make was in the academics. The real first exposure I had to what you would call honors classes, and then just the reading levels that those kids, those kids were reading novels in the seventh grade, and I don't think I would have read a novel until I reached high school if I had stayed in public school. I also remember very vividly attending that school, it being more of a diverse culture. That was the first time that I really experienced going to school with white kids, kids of international nature, whether it be Indian, Korean, Chinese. So I think in a lot of ways it prepared me for coming to Valparaiso University, but my experience in high school was quite different because I would still go home and it would still be my neighborhood and I could still fit in. My friends helped me stay grounded.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Courts rely on psychologists to determine if mentally ill or disabled defendants are competent to stand trial. When a psychologist recently admitted to falsifying one of these exams, it revealed a system that lacks oversight and can be very easily abused. Steve Berger continues his reports for us for Side Effects Public Media.
In July of 2015, Caleb Loving, a 27-year-old Evansville man, was charged with lighting fire to his apartment and possession of explosives. Though mentally disabled, he was declared competent to stand trial on the basis of two psychologists' examinations. His defense attorney, Stephen Owens, says that was a mistake.
He was not capable of understanding the significance of Miranda rights and making a knowing waiver of those rights.
On day three of his trial last summer, the judge declared a mistrial. One of the examining psychologists, Dr. Albert Fink, admitted that, in fact, he'd never seen Caleb Loving. After Fink confessed, Loving had two more mental competency exams and spent a few months in a state mental hospital. Ultimately, the judge in the case threw out much of what Loving told police after his arrest.
That whole non-evaluation, mistrial, reevaluation has cost Caleb a lot of months in jail. His case would have been resolved one way or the other by now.
Loving pleaded guilty to a reduced charge in the case. His sentencing is set for next month. Law enforcement in Vandenberg County suspect Fink may have falsified exams in 28 other cases. The reason he got away with it is a lack of oversight. Lawyers freely admit they don't understand these reports and rarely try, except for high-profile cases.
I don't know that I have enough skill or knowledge, I'm not sure any of us do, to definitively say one way or the other that this person actually got seen or not.
To learn more about Indiana's competency exams, I talked to Dr. George Parker of the Indiana University School of Medicine. He walks me through a typical exam.
What are the charges? How serious are they? What level are they? What could happen to you as a result of these charges?
Parker is a board-certified forensic psychiatrist who researches the intersection of mental health and the legal system.
What happens if somebody's found guilty or not guilty? Who are the typical court participants? And what do they do in court? So what's the judge's job?
In Indiana, he says,
you have to be pretty impaired to be incompetent to stand trial, actively psychotic, or intellectually disabled without very good verbal skills and difficulty learning new material. It takes some work.
While Indiana law says that evaluators must have expertise in determining competency, Parker says that's not always being followed in Indiana courts. There's also no system in place for checking up on the expertise levels of the providers conducting the exams, according to Owens, the chief public defender in Vandenberg County.
The qualifications for some people to do these evaluations are minimal, and that's
one of
the
problems. It meets the legal standard, though.
I don't think the judges look beyond that. Question is, should they look beyond that? I don't know. I mean,
well, I'm going to ask
somebody
as well.
Should.
Somebody has, in the growing number of states adopting certification and review standards for competency examiners. This fix could be made through legislative action or through a voluntary cooperative effort between mental health professionals and the Indiana Judges Association, for example. Dr. Parker says such a move in Indiana could give lawyers and judges an important tool to weed out bad actors like Albert Fink. For Side Effects, I'm Steve Berger.
Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt announced this week that the Trump administration will repeal the Clean Power Plan. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that Indiana and 27 other states previously sued the EPA over the Obama administration rule.
The U.S. Supreme Court blocked the rule from going into effect in 2016, a move that met the approval of industry groups such as the Indiana Coal Council. The Clean Power Plan would reduce carbon emissions from power plants by 30% nationwide in an effort to slow man-made climate change. Critics of the plan say the EPA doesn't have the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions that way, and the plan would make coal-generated power too expensive. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says he'll publish the repeal proposal Tuesday. The EPA is required to collect public comments on the plan, and the agency says it hasn't decided if it will propose an alternative rule to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Many major utilities, such as Indianapolis Power and Light and Vectren, are already using less coal in favor of low-cost natural gas and cheaper renewables. Environmental and climate groups, such as the Sierra Club and the Hoosier Environmental Council, have long supported the Clean Power Plan. They say cheap alternatives to coal hurt the industry, not overregulation. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
The American College of Surgeons, after what seemed to be a long review period, accredited the Methodist Hospital's Northlake campus in Gary as a Level 3 trauma center, the first such center in Lake County. The hospital first applied for accreditation about 2 years ago. Northwest Indiana surgeon Dr. Reuben Rutland and Jennifer Mullen, the hospital's trauma program coordinator, came into the studio here on Regionally Speaking to talk about the process to accreditation and how the end result will be better health care service here in Northwest Indiana. What about the procedure that the
state of Indiana itself as a whole is very immature in regard to trauma system development, but they've been working pretty tenaciously for the past, I would say, 5 to 6 years to establish some rules that help a traumatically injured patient get better care. One of those rules is a triage and transport rule that says if you meet a specific criteria as far as your injuries go and you're within 45 minutes of a trauma center, you should be transferred to that trauma center.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a rule that's called in the process of ACS verification. And what that process does is allows to a hospital that has the intention of becoming a trauma center and has the foundation of a trauma program in place to submit their application to the state to become state designated as a trauma center. We submitted that application about 3.5 years ago and were granted in the process status as a Level 3 trauma center in 2013, just exactly about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately in the state of Indiana, the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma are the people that come in and say, you are a trauma center now. And it's a fairly exhaustive process. You have to put about, I don't know the exact number, I should have counted, but I would say it's a close to 200, 250 criteria you have to meet.
Yeah.
And you have to have all of those things in place. Everything ranging from having a trauma surgeon like Dr. Rutland at the bedside within 30 minutes, having your OR available within 30 minutes, having your trauma care guidelines in place. having your nurses and your doctors trauma trained. So that's what we've been working on. And we had our visit in May for our verification. Mm-hmm. And we got the stamp of approval on August 11th.
That's
so
great.
We're very proud.
Dr. Redland, yes. you've been working here in Northwest Indiana for a while, and you know what the situation is. And the problem of Northwest Indiana not having a full-fledged trauma center has been going on for a number of years, and which is in large part why so many cases could have stayed in Northwest Indiana, but they end up going to Chicago or Chicago suburbs. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the problems that you run into and how this now, with the status of the Level 3 Trauma Center at Methodist, is going to help.
Well, the trauma center is very needed in the community. You know, besides the three highways that we have going through, sometimes we get patients from different areas, from assault as well as from gunshot wounds. And so a lot of these patients was being transferred out, and some of our population can't afford to make trips over to Chicago just to see their family members. So we're trying to bring that back home. You know, we have patients who are injured in the city. We try to bring them back. And I should say before we move on, Methodist took care of trauma patients well before. What Jennifer and I did is to come in and streamline the system, mm-hmm. to take a lot of the variability out of it. What we saw when we first got here, you have great emergency doctors, but some felt more comfortable with trauma and some felt less. So they used to activate the system at different times. And so what we did is come in and put a guideline in to say, this is what we're considering a trauma. This is when all hands on deck needs to be on. This is a standby. We don't need as many people. And we just kind of streamlined the system to make a good system better.
Does it turn out that, for example, if you want to call it that, traffic accident that does have injury, maybe with only one or two people involved, that doesn't maybe necessarily qualify unless they're a very, very serious accident with very, very serious injuries, I guess is what is discovered by the first responders. It'd be different than if you had a full-fledged emergency. If something happened, a number of people were hurt and the injuries in a number of people were serious, would that kick in that level of trauma where you'd have to be able to go through the injuries and sort them out and get them taken
right.
care of properly?
So what you're describing is kind of like a mass casualty situation where
right.
you have several people coming to the facility. What we do is we work with EMS and we triage patients. You know, as a trauma center, we want to get the sickest. If you have some people, what we call walk-in wounded or people who is not as severe, they may be better served going to a regular hospital in this instance. You know, the research shows that you have a better survivability when you go to a trauma center, but you can't overwhelm the trauma center. So just prime example, you know, you can't get 10 extremely injured patients at the same time to a trauma center. You're just going to overwhelm your resources, whether
right.
you're a level 1 or level 3. So we asked our EMS to say, send us the sickest, and then for the other patients that can benefit, that level does not reached the need of a trauma center, can they go to a regular hospital?
They'll still go to an emergency room, and they'll
right.
still be treated as an emergency room patient.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Just that it's a little different, the status. And you say if you have something that's is common like that, I suppose that probably that the most average cases are ones where you're not overwhelmed like that, but still it's a pretty serious situation, and that's where the trauma center is best helping.
Absolutely. We have two defined levels of trauma care. So those levels, we have our highest, most critically leveled, and then we have our mid-level. Each level has a defined team response. So if somebody comes in and, for example, they've been in a car accident and they have a very low blood pressure and we have a high suspicion that they're bleeding somewhere internally, mm-hmm. that's the team that is all hands on deck, like Dr. Rutland just said. We have a surgeon there, OR's on standby, anesthesia has a heads up, blood bank's coming, CAT scanner's getting cleared so we can image the patient. And then for the lesser critically injured people, we have a modified response where the ER team is running that patient and will contact all the resources as needed. So it's a very efficient way to use your resources, but to deliver the level of care that a patient needs.
That is Jennifer Mullen, who is the Trauma Program Coordinator, and we have with us in the studio Dr. Reuben Redland, who is one of the trauma surgeons at Methodist Hospitals, Northlake Campus. That is the center now that has an official, at least official, according to the American College of Surgeons, Level 3 Trauma Center, and it's been in operation for several years, but this new accreditation, does it put it in kind of like the gold standard, I suppose, of trauma centers, as it were?
Well, it's... I would have to say yes.
The reason why, as
trauma medical director for the hospital and working with Jennifer as the program coordinator, you know, one thing that we have to do is every trauma patient that comes into the hospital is reviewed. And our main question is, could we have done anything better? And we always question ourselves, even with the best run, you know, finely tuned machine, I think you always have to ask, can we do it better? Mm-hmm. And we meet and we're critical of each other. You know, if it was decided that you could have done something better or faster, we'd say that, you know, this was done well, but you know what? Let's do it better next time. And it led to nothing but to better trauma care for the region.
Now, I guess the last question I have to ask of you is to not necessarily get your opinion, but and your roles is how you work there at the trauma center with the impending changeover. Where the Methodist hospitals, North Lake and South Lake campuses, are going to become, if things go well, part of the Franciscan network. Will that change anything, as far as you know, for the trauma center? Will that make it easier on you folks? Or will you find that you'll still be, maybe you'll be expanding maybe even to the South Lake campus, if necessary?
Well, I think that's all yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs in that sentence, and I know Dr. Rutland and I are both committed to keep doing what we're doing until they tell us to do it a different way otherwise. But I think that in a way it would offer us some more resources. Geographically, the North Lake campus is the campus that where a trauma center is needed. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. I just don't know how.
Not very much is going to change, I would imagine. Well, that it's just, you know, regardless of the ownership, I suppose, of the facility.
Right. So. Well, we hope that when the Franciscans merge with the Methodists, that they have a high love for providing trauma care to Gary. You know, I understand they're supposed to build a new hospital that's going to be in the city, and hopefully, you know, we'll be there fighting to have a nice, you know, state-of-the-art trauma center. That's all we have to say.
I was going to ask about that too, because we know that is supposedly one of the things in the works. If the changeover is finalized, the plans call for the new hospital to be built not close to the current location there in Gary, but actually closer to IU Northwest to the campus there, just off the Borman Expressway. So you'll have a new facility, and that in turn will make some improvements as well too. You've done what you can, I know, with the facility that you have, and it's a very, very good facility for what you've had to do in the upgrade, and obviously you are, I'm sure, are looking forward to what you get to do for a brand new facility.
Well, we're looking forward. We would love to have a new facility, like everything. We would like to have something new, but you got to admit, Methodist has a beautiful new emergency department in North Lake that they spent some time and some talent to bring to pass.
Yeah, I think we have done a really great job with the resources we currently have. We got a lot of odds stacked against us, but we have really worked to deliver the very best trauma care that we can with the resources that we have right now, and I think that we're knocking it out of the park.
Right. It's definitely a labor of love.
Absolutely.
It would seem to, with the American College of Surgeons approving the accreditation here this summer for the facility that's opened up there in Gary, that they certainly think it's good. They think it's the best, certainly, for Northwest Indiana, and it's going to certainly keep you all very, very busy dealing with the emergencies as they come in. In the months and years ahead, I would imagine.
It's keeping us on our toes, that's for sure.
It definitely does. I mean, the American College Surgeons, if you can imagine every decision that has been made as a trauma center for the past 3 years being called on the carpet by elder surgeons who know all the good, the bad, and the evils of trauma. And every decision that has been made is up for question, and so it keeps you on your toes to stay on the cutting edge and to kind of to keep up with the trauma literature.
Now, having said that, what do your colleagues there at the hospital and other surgeons and other doctors here in Northwest Indiana have to say about the new Level 3 Trauma Center set up there at Methodist North Lake and trying to deal with Northwest Indiana's healthcare problems?
Well. Yeah, that's two different questions.
It's two really different questions.
Yeah, as far as the trauma center, we have nothing but praises. You know, I was thinking kind of what could I say about this when I was coming in. Prime example is anything new, people kind of are questionable. And one of the biggest things that I knew that we were taking hold as a trauma center was one of the times nurses on the floor, who was pretty much dead set of becoming the trauma center, just gave all type of roadblocks, excuses, and why not to become one. And I knew that we had buy-in from the hospital when she questioned me. And she says, you take care of people with traumatic injuries, but Dr. Rowland, you set nothing up for the mental injuries. And as a trauma surgeon, we are guilty of that. We take care of the body, and sometimes we forget the mind. And this was a patient who had a traumatic episode. And so she kind of helped set up a program that we can kind of talk to patients to get into them psychologists. This person is not even affiliated with Methodist for the most part, who understands that, you know, trauma can be mind-altering as well.
So you are getting cooperation from other segments of the healthcare industry and outside the hospital there in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. It's a huge component of being a trauma center. A lot of people have a misconception that trauma just occurs in the trauma bay of the emergency department, and that's really not true. A huge component of what we've done is we've reached out to the community to build really strong resources and community partnerships with people that we know will give us support. We could do injury prevention, we do outreach, and that was a really good example of how a community partner offered to help our traumatically injured patients. And so it's good trauma care. Great trauma care is really about, you know, from what happens at the time the patient's injured all along the time until they're discharged and every single step in between. So I'd like to clear that misconception up. It's not about the ER.
And including not just to the time they're discharged, you know, we're held just as responsible for getting patients to rehab centers, you know, in a quality time. You know, as a trauma surgeon, people think that I lurk around the ER waiting for a patient to come in. The ER is just where I meet my patient. I'm down there usually, hopefully, no more than a golden hour of trauma. But I leave, and we're with that patient for the rest through the ICUs, through the ORs, through the floors, and then until the patient sometimes goes to inpatient rehab and follow up. And, you know, the trauma surgeon acts as a quarterback, specifically when there's different body parts or different subspecialties that's involved. And so we just have to do that. And we say we have to do it, but it's like what we want to do. I keep saying it's a labor of love.
That's Northwest Indiana surgeon Dr. Reuben Rutland, and with him, Jennifer Mullen, who is the Trauma Program Coordinator at the Methodist Hospital's North Lake Campus in Gary. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Average retail gasoline prices are up slightly here in Northwest Indiana, but they're down across the nation. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with the senior petroleum analyst for GasBuddy.com, Patrick DeHaan, yesterday with some more insight on the report.
In terms of the weekly prices in Gary, I noticed that the prices in Gary are up while the national prices, you say, are going down?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, prices in Gary, really the only area across Indiana that's on increase. The statewide average in Indiana is actually down about 10 cents a gallon. Gary is up about a nickel. Looking at some of the other areas across Indiana, Fort Wayne saw about a 12-cent a gallon decline in the last week, and Indianapolis right there at about 11-cent decline. So we saw a number of stations in Northwest Indiana jumping early, I should say mid last week, because wholesale gas prices shot up, but many places didn't follow because the next day wholesale prices went right back down. So kind of one an unlucky break in Northwest Indiana, but prices have already retreated in some areas back under $2.20 a gallon.
So, and I understand from what you had said in your release that Hurricane Nate didn't really disrupt things.
That's right. Nate was a relatively minor storm, and the other benefit was it was very fast moving. And so there wasn't as much damage to major infrastructure, thus there will be no impact to gas prices. Now, it's worth noting, however, that in some areas across Indiana, the retail price of gasoline has gone down much faster than the wholesale price of gasoline. There's kind of a price phenomenon we've talked about in Indiana that's called price cycling, in which stations start to drop their price, and eventually they drop their price under where they sell it. And what can happen then is that stations may reset prices. And we, due to that price cycling behavior, may see prices inch up towards midweek or later this week, just depending on how quickly those prices continue to retreat.
So what causes that to happen? What's behind the price cycling?
A lot of intense competition, essentially a price war every day. In fact, that's a phenomenon that we see across much of the Great Lakes. Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio were all in the top five states for the largest gas price declines in the last week, because essentially these stations continue to undercut prices day in and day out until they start losing money, which then starts that price cycle in which stations raise their prices, and then after the cycle of hikes, prices start to go back down. And it's a phenomenon that repeats every 1 to 2 weeks or so, in which we see a big jump, prices retreat for a week or two, and then they make another big jump. And so we could see one of those jumps here later this week.
And is there any way to tell, like, what's going to happen next week with the gas prices, or is it something that you just learn on as the time comes?
Well, you know, right now it's kind of a you know, last-minute approach. Overall, national average is down about 6 cents. We continue to see much of the country going down because of relief from Hurricane Harvey. Of course, Harvey shut down a lot of gasoline production, and that's why we saw prices go up. But overall, price is kind of very similar to what we've seen over the last few months. Price in the low $2 a gallon range. Believe it or not, prices in Indiana now only a penny higher than they were a year ago. So we're kind of stuck in this rut of prices in the low $2 a gallon range.
Well, thanks so much, Patrick. I really appreciate your time, always.
Sure, you're very welcome.
It's Patrick DeHaan, who is the Senior Petroleum Analyst for GasBuddy.com. The 2017 academic year, just a couple months old, but there have already been some records set at Purdue University in Northwest. Carmen Panlilio is the Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management and Student Affairs, and she was on Regionally Speaking to tell us that records being set for student retention and for the number of freshman students at both the Hammond and the Westfield campuses.
When we talk student retention, we're talking about the freshmen from last year coming back to be sophomores this year. And I think you already know it went up almost 8% in the one-year time span. And people keep on asking us why or how this happened.
68.2%, which is up 7.5% from last year. And it's turned out it's the highest ever for the university. And we're going back a number of years, even back to the years when Purdue Northwest was just basically known as Purdue Calumet and Purdue Westville, and they were pretty much commuter campuses.
Yes, they were. But one of the things that we actually do want to emphasize is the fact that it's Purdue Northwest now, and the fact that we're looking at numbers that represent both locations, both campuses. So it's not just the Purdue Calumet or the Purdue Westville. So the 68%, especially because it was 60-something percent last year, is something we're really proud of. And I really think it speaks to the quality of our students. More than anything else. There is now a uniform admission standard for both locations. So we have really excellent students coming in. Their average GPA is 3.24, I believe, and that's another record right there. But Chris, if I may, one of the things that we're also really proud of is what we've been doing on campus in terms of helping the students actually come back. And this is where I think the real reason for retention being so good comes in. It's the support and the engagement that the students feel when they do come to be part of PNW. For example, we had year-long new student orientation, so to speak. It was a year-long orientation. It wasn't just the orientation that students go to before classes start. This time around, we had so many events going on in the fall semester as well as in the spring semester, so that as the students were finding their feet, so to speak, on campus and meeting all of these new friends and seeing all of the requirements for college, and again, this is all very new to them, they were getting the help they needed. There were the student ambassadors were there, the new student orientation leaders were there, but other student support service offices were there as well. Our Disability Access Center, for example, was front and center so that the students who might need some type of help in terms of transitioning and or continuing with any of the accommodations they may have had when they were in K through 12 would find it and not flounder and be lost. Our counseling center, our career center, and then, of course, we can never, ever, ever discount the engagement of just being part of or watching the different sports teams on campuses, on both locations as well. So these are all the little things, the engagement and the support that the whole campus has been working on. And this is in addition to tutoring and supplemental instruction. So it's both academic and social. I think that's the real best combination as far as improving retention.
I suppose that even as well, although it's not to as great an extent, because it's not a big percentage of the student population, but residential life has something to do with it too, having the opportunity, if a student chooses, to be able to live on campus.
Oh, thank you for reminding me of that, Chris. And shame on me for not saying it, but you're absolutely right. Even if it's a small percentage, housing, university housing and residential education, that's a huge deal. And in fact, one of the other things that we're proud of is this is the highest in terms of occupancy we've had for our university housing. In fact, towards the end of this summer, we had this amazing problem of having more than 100% in terms of applicants to stay in our dorms. And I hope Scott Iverson, our executive director of housing, forgives me for using the word dorms, but I'm old-fashioned enough to refer to them that way.
I know. I catch myself doing that, too, in residence halls.
But then again, residence halls, dorms, right. Whatever else they might be, they do provide another anchor on campus. And right now, we're at the highest in terms of occupancy. And like I said, before the semester started, we had 101 applications. So that was a wonderful problem to have, trying to figure out who we could accommodate. And they do add to the college experience, the college life.
One of the things I'd like, if you would, to mention, too, and the information that came out from campus about these great figures is the full-time freshman population this year, as we start another school year, it's up a bit, and there's some other good stats as well, too, on the on-campus undergraduate student body.
This is the fourth time in a row that our incoming freshmen, that over 95% are actually full-time, and the percentage of our students who are traditional age is also consistently, again, amazingly high. In fact, it's been so high that over the years, we've moved the needle to having a total percentage of our students being traditional age. Mm-hmm. So this idea of Purdue Northwest, formerly Calumet or Westville, being for non-traditional students, for students who plan to start and then stop, that kind of thing. That's an old idea of who we are at this point. Now they're traditional age, younger, more intent on finishing in 4 years.
And Carmen Pandolio says that they'll be watching very closely and assisting any new students on campus to help them along so that they'll remain in school. The number of teens that are working at a part-time job has dropped significantly since the late 1990s. Education experts say that a part-time job can give students a competitive edge when it comes to college admissions. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright tells us, they're also expected to volunteer, participate in clubs, and more, all while keeping up their grades.
When Nicole Klee opens up her locker, it's immediately clear there's no wasted space.
This is my AP Chem binder.
It doesn't fully fit in it.
It doesn't fully fix. It's too big.
Klee is a junior at Franklin Central High School. She has a full schedule. She's a soccer player, participates in student council, and takes several advanced classes.
I keep my chemistry notes in the back.
The course load is trying at times, but it pays off. The 16-year-old is ranked 38th out of more than 700 in her class. But Klee recently wanted to add another thing to her plate, a part-time job.
I think there's a lot of people who feel pressured to get jobs so that they can pay for a car and to go out and do things.
Her parents offer her money, but for Klee, it's about independence. Ultimately, though, it just wasn't doable. When Klee really looked at it, there simply weren't enough hours in the day.
You don't have time for all of that, and you need to pick things that are important to you and things that will help you in the long run. And for me, that was sports and school.
The challenge is clear. Klee is just too busy. Although some students don't have an option and need an income or to save for college, studies show Klee isn't alone. 75% of teens were working jobs in the 1970s. That dropped to around 55% in 2014. Tim Siegert, the director of counseling at Franklin Central, says students are busier than ever, and preparing for the next level is getting more rigorous.
Because those admission standards are getting more stringent, parents are even saying, we want you focused more on taking a heavier course load, focusing more on extracurricular activities too, whether it be a sport, band, volunteer service.
Siegert says there are clear pros and cons to teens working part-time jobs. Colleges are looking for well-rounded students, and working a job shows good time management and discipline. But in turn, a student's academics can suffer. Indiana Commissioner for Higher Education Teresa Lubbers says other research shows college undergrads who work 20 hours or less are more likely to have a higher GPA.
If you work, you know, closer over 20 hours, then it is a challenge. Less than 20 hours, it may be an advantage.
The key is balance, and officials say there are other ways besides working a part-time job to acquire the skills college admissions are looking for.
What you need to do is find a way to distinguish your academic career by other supplemental experiences that say who you are and what you're committed to doing and what kind of a student or what kind of an employee you would be.
And thanks to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright for that piece. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with IU Northwest Dean of Students, Beth Tyler.